Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donald on a Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. Thank you for joining us today. Well, spring is really fickle. We had a bit of snow, and it is not really spring-like weather. It is. Watch those tender plants outside there. If you've got stuff out there, be careful. We have some freezing nights.
Yeah. I covered a couple of my outdoor planters that I had started. I covered them with towels last night. And apparently I will have to do it again tonight and tomorrow night.
I think so. We've got snow. We've got north wind. Oh, boy. Stay with us. We can move into spring yet. I know it'll come.
We're close. We're really close. Yeah.
Today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we're going to talk about lime pie, wages, bluebells, and some other stuff too.
Yeah, we got a smorgasbord today.
Yeah,
for
smorgasbord.
You.
That's a food thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Lime pie. Well, lime pie. I got this recipe from online from the New York Times recipe people, and I said, I looked at that recipe and I can do this recipe. It's a real simple sort of thing. It just has eggs, can of sweetened condensed milk, and lime juice, and that's about it for the filling. 5 large egg yolks plus 3 large egg whites, all at room temperature. 1 14-ounce can sweetened condensed milk. 2/3 cup fresh lime juice, and then some more lime zest for garnish if you would like. And that goes into a pie shell, and it was really good. It ended up really fluffy and nice. And
it was delicious.
Oh, I served some to Donna, and she said, it's a chiffon pie. And I hadn't heard. I thought chiffon was the kind of stuff that 1930s movie starlets wore in their boudoirs.
Silk chiffon.
Oh, but
actually, even into the early 60s, I can remember one of my first dance party dresses that my mother made. The top was velvet and the bottom was silk chiffon. And that is a marvelous fabric.
It doesn't make a bad pie either.
No.
So this floor, it was called the Florida lime pie. Not a key lime pie, because key limes you sit down are a specific lime.
Yeah, they're a little bit smaller than the kind of lime. I mean, sometimes you can get them in the grocery store here, but they're smaller, maybe like an inch into an inch and a half in diameter, as opposed to the usual ones that we see in the grocery store. And they have just a slightly different flavor, but they, I would say, for cooking are quite interchangeable.
Right. Well, this just happens to be the kind of lime that you can get in Iowa in April. Nothing fancy, but it does take quite a bit of lime juice, a 2/3 cup of lime juice. Also, it takes a can of sweetened condensed milk, and that's an interesting invention. We've had sweetened condensed milk. Canned milk has been around for a long time. And this has got the
sugar. Well, certainly in the 20th century, anyway.
That's a long time. We've been
One more thing about the chiffon bit.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
The difference between a chiffon pie and like a take your now lemon meringue. Maybe we'll make a lemon meringue this summer. I love a lemon meringue pie. But that does not, in that lemon meringue pie, you do not whip the egg whites. So to make the chiffon part, you have whipped the egg whites, which makes the fluffy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Quite. It was very, very pretty, very light tasting.
Well, and she put whipped cream
on
top.
Well, it's here in the recipe, whipped cream for garnish, and something about that, the bite of the lime and whipped cream for garnish. Now, I have a question, Donna. Part of this recipe said you blind bake the pie crust. You make a regular pie crust with flour, salt, unsalted butter and a little ice water, make a pie crust. But you bake that in the oven before you put the filling in. And it says to use pie weights. I didn't have pie weights.
Right. Pie weights are kind of, it's like a long string of little metal beads. And you kind of just, the thing with blind baking, so it's when you need a pre-baked pie crust, like with a lemon meringue pie or a coconut cream pie, all of these old-timey favorites. So you cook the pie crust first, and you have to put a weight in the bottom of the pan, because if there's no filling in it, it kind of puffs up and flakes off.
Right.
So you use the dried beans. That's another old.
I use dry beans.
And how many did you use?
Enough to fill the
like
bottom.
Like a half cup or something?
Yeah, at least. Because enough to fill the bottom of the pie crust. I have tried it without putting any weight on there. I've learned my lesson. I had a poofy kind of
right.
pie crust
work.
Cookie.
Yeah.
No. So then but I do have a question. The beans look just fine. And then I had beans left over when I poured them out of the pie crust. I wonder if these are any good. So I soaked them, and I think we had bean soup that night. It seemed to work. It did go into a hot oven, but the beans will seem to be fine.
Well, the only thing it would do probably to the bean is dry them out further. Mm-hmm. So that would mean when you're rehydrating the beans, which is what you're doing when you're cooking a dried bean, you might just have to cook them longer. And also, here's the thing about dried beans. You know, people think they store forever, which they sort of do. But even in the process, over time, they get drier and drier and drier. So the older a bean is and the longer it's been stored, the longer you will have to cook it to make it soft. So I suppose the same thing would be if you'd already toasted them in the oven. You just cook them a little longer.
There you go.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a guess, but.
This lime pie was a hit. I will make it again. It is very good. And you make the pie
all right, crust. Lana, let's make a deal to have a lemon meringue pie this summer, too.
Oh, good idea. Yeah. That kind of deal I can go with. I like that a lot. And again, what makes this a chiffon, a lovely light thing, is all of the beating of the eggs. You start out with 5 egg yolks separated. Mm-hmm. And you beat those egg yolks in... And with the condensed milk and the lime juice. And that's in one little bowl. In another bowl, there are 3 egg whites. I don't know what they do with the extra two egg whites you have left over. But then you beat those egg whites until they are stiff white peaks. And then you mix those two together and you have a whole bowl full of puffy stuff. Then it says you put it in the cooled pie shell. And then you put
cooled
baked pie shell, right. The one that take the beans out first, please.
Right.
And then you put the pie back on in the oven and reduce the oven heat from 350 to 325 and cook for 20 minutes. So just to set the egg whites. And don't forget the whipped cream when you take it out later and serve it.
Well, see, now the difference between the chiffon and the not chiffon is almost like a chocolate. The difference between a chocolate mousse, which is fluffy, and a chocolate pudding, which is not fluffy. So that's kind of the equivalent.
Oh, good. Good. Lime pie. I like that.
Oh, and we were going to talk about condensed milk, too?
Oh, we didn't know what the heck condensed milk was.
It's milk that's been reduced in its liquid and canned with sugar.
There it is.
So there's evaporated milk, which is not sweetened. And then there's the condensed milk, which is sweetened.
There it is. There.
And we were also going to mention that our friend Paula, who is from Chile, makes her own dulce de leche by boiling a can of condensed milk until it reduces and it caramelizes. And then you end up with dulce de leche. So.
Condensed milk, a useful thing. Yes,
good. Have a few tricks with condensed milk.
Lime pie. I may get this recipe up on the website someday, folks. But otherwise, you can look it up. It is part of the New York Times. Look for lime pie in the New York Times recipe pages on online.
But they didn't use the word chiffon. Maybe that's...
No chiffon. They call
that must be an old-fashioned.
It is. It
oh,
is.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Okay.
Well, we try to bring old things up every now and then.
Does it have condensed milk?
Yeah. It does have condensed milk in it.
So, on to the next thing. Wages. Wages. There's no transition here.
We're going to talk about money now.
Okay. So, how much money do you need to get by? How much money do you need to make you happy? We hear about the divide between those at the top of the economic ladder and, well, basically the rest of us.
Yes, yeah, they're saying that inequality in America is greater than it has ever been between the billionaire class, which used to be millionaire class, but now they are billionaire class, and the rest of us.
Ha!
And how it is apparently destabilizing our society.
How about that? Well, joining us in the around the kitchen table here today is Joe Lynch. I happen to be married to Joe Lynch. You know, when you live with someone like Joe Lynch, he's finding things on the internet, and he always says, you know, you should talk about this on the radio. And so I said, yeah, Joe, you should. Right. So Joe Lynch is going to talk about this interesting article that he found about wages and wage discrepancies. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen, Joe Lynch.
Thanks for having me. This is great fun. The first thing I want to say is you say there's no connection between this and cooking. Well, there is, because if you can't afford the food that you need to eat,
you still got to cost something, right?
Things are all tied together. But this is a very interesting situation that I uncovered by accident the other day. A CEO of a credit card processing company by the name of Dan Price criticized roundly for doing what? Lowering his own salary.
Ooh.
Okay. He lowered his salary from $1.1 million a year to $70,000 a year. That's all he did. He didn't cut anyone else's salary. The other thing he did do, though, was because he lowered his own salary, he was able to increase the salary of everyone in his organization to $70,000 a year. And guess what? He was roundly criticized by people.
He was called a socialist.
That's right. But the real issue is that people need a living wage. And he realized that. And the incident that made him realize that, he discovered that one of his employees was having to keep a second job working at McDonald's in order to pay her bills. And he decided that he was a terrible CEO if that was happening.
Yeah, and apparently this is not an uncommon situation. Lots of lower wage earners have to have second jobs.
Okay, fast forward to 6 years later. He has, his company name is Gravity Payments. They process credit cards. Everyone in his company now makes $70,000 or more. In that 6 years, the company that was predicted to fail by his critics has tripled its processing income, has done amazing things for the people that work there. And what even is more interesting to me is, because of the pandemic, their company had a complete sea change in the way they were having to market what they were doing, and their revenue, their customer base was cut in half almost overnight. And guess what happened? All those people that were paid a decent salary came together. Some of them sacrificed part of their salary for a while in order to get through this rough spot and figure out how among them to solve their current crisis, not of their making. And now they're doing better than ever. And they're doing better than ever because everybody pulled together and worked hard to solve the problem.
And he has terrific retention of employees.
That's right.
Which is, in business, it's very expensive to constantly be changing because you have to retrain, you have to find, you have to, you know, it becomes a big business expense. So he doesn't have any of those problems. So it has worked
in,
for him.
In 6 years, they have gone from 130 employees to 200. They've opened a new office in Boise. Their original office is in Seattle, where their costs are less, but they're still paying their staff $70,000 a year or more. In that 6 years, our revenue has tripled. The number of employees has gone up 70%. Their customer base has doubled. Their staff's families are growing. They've paid down their debt. They have bigger 401ks. Their turnover has dropped in half. All of this because people feel like they're taken care of, and they therefore bust their butts to make the company successful.
Well, it is a bit old fashioned, I have to say. What I like about it is, this is not a political statement. This is a moral and ethical issue. You know, it's like they called him a socialist, but he's not a socialist. He's just a capitalist doing the way he wants. So, but if we don't think of it in terms of socialism, capitalism, communism, all the isms that are political, instead we just think of it, this man was not being greedy. You know, he was really thinking about the larger way to his social responsibilities as a leader.
And again, we're also talking about excess here.
Yeah.
You know, he's lowered the often 1,000-time difference in salary between a CEO and the lowest paid person in a corporation to, in his corporation, they've lowered it to 4 times.
Yeah.
And I hesitate to say everybody's happy, you know, and he was, of course, soundly criticized for this because his message, by simply cutting his own salary, is completely flies in the face of what's now considered normal, which is
get as much as you can, as fast as you can.
Yeah, and what's to be? How does one spend $1 billion? You know, I'm sorry.
Well, you use it to influence political campaigns, apparently, and send moon rovers to Mars because we're destroying our planet. So we might have to go live somewhere else, but only if really rich people can do this. Frankly, I don't want to live on Mars. If we screw it up here, I think I'll go down with the ship. Sounds good.
But there, the point is, there's solutions to these problems.
Absolutely. You know? And they're old-fashioned solutions. We were just talking about this. I remember growing up, what's that famous saying from the Bible? It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, what does that mean? That means being greedy is not good for you.
And camels are too big.
Camels are too big to go through needles. Everybody knows
that.
Well,
and actually that means that maybe some of our wants and desires and some of our greed is too big, too.
Yes. And it just becomes all too much to manage, you know?
Goodness.
And, you know, what do you do with $1 billion? You hire tax attorneys to so that you can
pay taxes
so you feel even more disconnected from the rest of the planet.
Oh my goodness. It sounds complicated, but you know what? It's just not.
And I love this as proof.
This is such a good story because it illustrates so many things that everybody says, oh, this is economics. You can't really understand this, you know.
We can't afford to pay more than $7 an hour for minimum wage, and on and on.
Yeah, it's just not. And if we go back to, you know, showing our ages here, but, you know, I grew up in a town in Illinois that's about the same size as Ames. And we had a family business, which was office supplies and stationery and equipment and typewriters and stuff, all the things that Staples has driven out of business. But when you have a business like that, and my family had, I mean, there were, you know, maybe 15 people worked in the store. There was the guy that repaired the typewriters, the delivery boys, the bookkeeper, the people that waited on customers. And I was one of them. My family was really, you know, I have to hand it, this was my mother, was very good about making sure that everybody's needs were met. And, you know, because you knew all of your employees, you knew their families, we took care of each other.
And we're trading that for Amazon warehouses where people aren't allowed time to go to the bathroom.
What's wrong with us? We are going to hell in a handbasket here.
Yeah, I don't need things that badly, thank you. I wonder if Mr. Dan Price from his company is named Gravity Payments. I wonder if he can eke out a living. Can he survive on $70,000? Oh my goodness!
Statement. This is a great statement. Let me see if I can find it. It says, I made a lot of personal changes, but I still had savings and made a fair salary. I don't miss anything about the millionaire lifestyle. Money buys happiness when it gets you out of poverty, but when it gets you from well off to very well off, it's not a solution to anything.
There you have it, from a man with experience. I mean, you often read that Warren Buffett is very modest too, that he lives in the same house he's lived in for, I don't know, 50 years or something. And he's made statements like, well, when my secretary pays a higher rate of income tax than I do, there's something wrong with this system. And I think that's why people...
And he's also advocating raising his taxes on himself.
Yes. Ooh, yes. Yes. Well, there is a movement afoot, it seems, that some of these large corporations that have not been paying taxes, if they paid taxes, we could have better infrastructure. Right. Hello. We'll see. Stay tuned, folks. We'll see.
Everybody benefits from better infrastructure.
Exactly. All of us need
including
that.
Including the well-off. Yeah. Including the billionaires.
Very good. So let's think about what our needs are. What do we need to get by? And what about this money stuff?
Greed. And watch out for that greed.
I think that's really important to keep things in perspective. Realize that we are more than a paycheck. Human beings are a lot bigger than that. And it's time that we make sure there's a little equity that
goes
around.
It also goes into this whole thing about philanthropy. You know, Bill Gates and all the big boys, they want to give it away. But actually what they're doing is they're giving it to buy political consent and other kinds of consent. And they're choosing, you know, like, I mean, it's fine that Bill Gates is contributing to having more vaccines in this emergency that's going on. However, I would prefer it if this money were paid in taxes to the government. And as a group, we all decided how to spend this money rather than just one man's prerogatives.
And it's so out of control that the money that Amazon has made since the pandemic started is enough money by itself, just that increase, to make it possible for everybody on the planet to have fresh water. They could take that money and give fresh water to everybody on the planet.
Yeah, but Amazon isn't going to do that.
No, they're not.
If they just paid their taxes, then the government can do that. What about?
We could all do it in different ways. So it's a complicated business. There's no doubt. But.
Oh my goodness.
Let's think about resources. Allocating resources. I think that'd be a very, very good thing. We'll come back and talk more with Joe Lynch about some other things. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a tune. That was a tune for spring. It is a Finnish folk tune, and the title is my Finnish is not so good, but it's called Metsäkukkia, and it translates roughly to flowers of the forest. And guess what? Something good to eat this time of year, you can find it in the forest. We're going to be talking about bluebells, eating bluebells. Now, there's a word. Donna likes this word. Ephemeral.
Spring ephemeral.
Spring ephemeral are all those wonderful flowers that just sort of hop up overnight, especially on the forest floor, but all over. They're tiny. They're sweet. They come up for a short time.
And many of them are edible.
And many of them are edible, by golly. And Donald Priskintis and Joe Lynch are going to talk about eating bluebells. First, describe what a bluebell is, what it looks like, and we'll talk about eating them.
Well, right now is the peak of spring ephemerals, at least at our house. And the bluebells are my favorite spring ephemeral.
They're so pretty.
They're gorgeous. And they have this gorgeous dark green stalk and leaves and these droopy blue and pink flowers that are off the charts in the way they look.
And they come up in recognizable bunches. That's do spread. We didn't have any in our woods maybe 20 years ago. They were very rare, and now it's fun.
And now they're everywhere.
They're
literally
everywhere.
Well, and so Lana and I have been following this forager, which his website is foragerchef.com. His name is Alan Burgo, and he sends a newsletter out. You can sign up for it. So if you want to get the newsletter, he's really a lot of fun. Foragerchef.com. So he sent just this week a thing on Virginia bluebells or borage greens with walnut sauce. And so when Joe was raving about the bluebells, I said, oh my goodness, I'll send you this. And Joe cooked it up. So, and what he says about we talked about ramp pesto a few weeks ago, which I have been making several times, and I love it. It's a great recipe. So this recipe, he also, bluebells, like the ramps, he is picking, you know, when you're foraging, you don't want to kill off the whole colony because you want them to keep growing next year so you can find them again. So for both the ramps and the bluebells, you selectively pick just some of it and you leave plenty of it. And since you're only clipping the top parts of the plants, you don't damage it and it keeps growing.
In the case of the bluebell, you just clip the stem off near the ground because the plant will come back as it is. But you want the stem because the stem is delicious and edible.
The forager says the stem is the best part of the plant. And it does have, you know, most forage greens kind of have the same forage green flavor, except for dandelions, of course, which are really bitter. But the bluebell has a particularly, it's delicate, but how would you describe the flavor, Joe?
Well, it's, first of all, the stem, to prepare the bluebell, you just steam it for 30 seconds. That's literally all
fast.
You have to do. It's fast.
Right.
but it makes the stems edible, but still crunchy. So it adds a great texture to the dish. And then you can also eat the leaves and the blossoms. And this, the taste is delicate, but certainly not strong. And it's the combination of things when you mix it with the rest of the ingredients, which is a walnut paste or some nut that you like.
Right. He uses black walnuts, which would certainly be strong. Or in the picture he sent with it, he's got some hazelnuts and regular walnuts. So what you toast the nuts and you crush them with garlic?
I did not toast the nuts.
Oh.
I just crushed them with garlic. And
did you cook the garlic?
No.
Oh, you used, it was really good, Joe.
Yeah, it's raw. It's that raw garlic taste. It's hard to beat. Walnuts, raw garlic, olive oil, lemon juice. I think that's essentially,
and then you
and
just
salt and pepper.
Toss it with the lightly.
Crush that mixture up first. Uh-huh. And then toss it with the greens.
It was really delicious. Now you guys, you can find this yourself at Forager, all one word, foragerchef.com. He's really good. And he has a book coming out, I think in June or something, that I am already going to buy. And so we will be talking about what else is in the book. But he's lots of fun, and about once a week
and
or less.
We just learned from him this morning that not only are bluebells edible, but spring beauties are edible. They're what family?
Was that the Claytonia family?
Yeah. Yeah,
Miner's lettuce, right.
And trout lily leaves are edible. Lily shoots before they get big are edible, but they have
You have to cook those.
No, yeah, you can't
eat them. He does give all the appropriate caveats.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
It's fun. It's just really fun.
Do read the fine print, but there's a lot of edibles. And this time of year, after we've, imagine if we were living 200 or 300 years ago, the idea of something fresh and green coming up. What
yes.
a treat.
The spring cleanse.
Yes. But the sap from the maple trees, just as a spring tonic is lovely, depending on if you want to make sap or syrup or not. But these things that come up, the earth waking up again.
The ephemerals. And it is fleeting, because a lot of these get tough as the summer goes on. And you know, they're just not as pleasant to eat. But right now, and what's that thing, Lana, that you picked that we put in the salad the other day?
Oh, another thing to look for, just starting, Virginia waterleaf.
Well, it's been out a couple of weeks, actually.
Yeah, and that's just a salad.
I've got that in the backyard, and it's got, you see it, because it has kind of a variegated leaf with kind of white splotches on it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... You don't pick it and go, it has a really fabulous distinctive flavor, but it's really...
And we just learned a few minutes ago that the blossoms of Virginia waterleaf, while they're still in the bud stage, are delicious to eat.
But we're not there yet.
No, that's going to
right. Okay, we'll watch for that.
No, Virginia waterleaf is giving us will be giving us ground cover looking stuff all over. I mean, it does spread, and it's pretty easy to find the leaves, but... about a month. It takes a while, but then they put up these stalks with these multi-headed poofy flowers on them, and I didn't know that those were edible too.
But
how about that?
Pick them before they bud, while they're still in the bud stage, before the flowers
right.
actually blossom.
So you got to be right on it all
right.
the time.
Oh,
got to be out there paying attention.
Well, it's good to pay attention. Things are good. Well, it's good to be brave. Why should it be brave and strange to eat stuff out of the woods when we go down the fast food aisle and put all sorts of stuff in our mouth? Let's kind of get back to the stuff that we can harvest ourselves. And Donna, you found things like ramps just kind of in walks in the woods, and you don't necessarily need your own woodlot to do this sort of thing.
No, it's I mean, you know, if you're picking in random places, you probably don't want to pick right along the edge of the sidewalk because everyone's dog is peeing there. But, you know, back and through. And then, of course, I bring it home and soak. I just put it in cold water and soak it for a little bit, like 5 minutes or something.
Good.
And I'm going to do nettles in the next few days.
Oh, that's right.
Now, I'll take some gloves with me when I go out on my walk and a little pair of scissors and.
That's right.
Oh, and look, from the same guy, Forager Chef, was we mentioned a few weeks ago, he has a dish with ricotta cheese in nettles. So we'll be doing that. So foragerchef.com.
Good. And we'll be looking forward to the book that's coming out of this, too. Well, we've had some good weather and we've had some wintry weather. And instead of being out in the garden during the really unpleasant sort of cold winter weather, Joe and I took a little side trip here, did a little staycation. We stayed in Ames and spent an afternoon doing some things we just didn't get around to before. There are some really nice galleries. I love going to art galleries.
Oh, right. This is one of the benefits of ISU.
Yeah. They have a lot of good campus art. And we went to the Brunier Art Museum last week, and we went to the Christian Peterson Art Museum, their Campbell Gallery. And it's just nice to do that. Just take your time and go through. There is a landscape and environment themed sort of of thing going on at the ISU Museum that is the at the Brunier Art Museum.
That's in the Schiemann building. Yes. Right.
It's a very nice gallery. 25 years ago, matter of fact, pretty much when I was pretty new to Ames, they did an exhibit called Land of the Fragile Giants. And that was a gathering of landscapes, environments, and things. This is kind of a revisit of that theme. It's called Compelling Ground, Landscapes, Environments, and Peoples of Iowa. The original artists were asked to create original work inspired by Iowa, but instead of focusing on a singular region, they focus on the entire state. And there's paintings, there's sculptures, there's video pieces, there's pottery, and it was lovely. 19 separate artists contributed to this exhibition. It's just worth going through it. It's a real nice exhibition. It is up until June 23rd, so you can go to the Brunier and find the show called Compelling Ground at the Brunier Art Museum. It's worth a visit. And then something else we did. There's the old Morrill Hall, the old land-grant building, right kind of in the center of campus. Part of that has been turned into an art museum.
And the building itself is really pretty fun to visit.
It is. I wish to say that I used to work there. It used to be just an office building, and it was kind of down at the heels when I was working mm-hmm. there. It had like bats and things that you just learned to live with. But now it is a jewel. It's lovely stuff inside. And there's the Christian Peterson Art Museum is the whole thing. But there's a gallery on the first floor called the Campbell Gallery. And it's featuring the work of Rose Franson. Rose Franson has an exhibit called Perceptions of Identity. She is a fantastic painter.
Iowa artist.
And it is lots of, for those of you who like representational work, who can go in and say, oh, yeah, that is a picture of something. Go in there and you will see pictures of really fine portraits of people.
Oh, she's an amazing painter.
In this a collection of portraits of people paintings, there are things added. So she uses optical illusions to address perceptions of identity. Get that, okay? So you're kind of getting a little bit more than just pictures of people.
Well, and isn't it Rose Franson that painted that picture that's in the ISU collection of
George Washington Carver?
George Washington Carver teaching Henry Wallace or something like that.
That was commissioned by ISU, and that is in there too. And that's just a lovely picture. Her pictures have a lot of story behind them. You want to know what's going on. It's a beautiful picture of the idea of passing along the magic of science, the magic of agriculture, and that's there too. So you can visit
that. She also in Maquoketa, if you're touring the eastern part of the states for a little road trip at some point, she has a studio and a gallery in Maquoketa where you can see a lot of her work. I think Joe and I visited there several years ago. She's a remarkable Iowa artist. Rose Franson, Franzen, is that?
Franzen. Yes. Yeah. So look for her. She has a lovely thing. And that is at the Christian Peterson Art Museum in the old Morrill Hall, right next to Beardshire Hall, the center of ISU. And there's a sculpture garden around that building too. Lots of things to visit.
And when I do my little art tours of campus, I also really appreciate that we have the Grant Woods murals in the library. Those are just a national treasure. It's the colors that he even uses in there. And the other building on campus is the Farmhouse Museum, which is always fun to visit.
Oh, that had something I forgot. We didn't go there, but that has something in it currently.
We'll have to go there.
We'll have to go there.
Now that it's spring and we're vaccinated, we can get out and about. Yeah. And that sounds fun.
Go for a stroll. Rose Franson's art is available to be seen at that museum until July 30th. So put that on your calendar when it's raining sometime or you just want to get out of the house. Do that.
Yeah, you don't have to go to Chicago to go to an art museum.
Right. We have things to do here. Yes, we do. And it's nice to have a local artist. Actually, the other artists in the Brunier also make you kind of glad you live in Iowa. And just see all that pretty stuff and makes you think too. It's an amazing thing. And I go on the ISU website to find when the galleries are open, but as I recall, the times are quite generous. So, like, I don't know, 10 to 5 or something like that. It's not hard to find a time to go see them. Great. Well, we're going to be doing another tune here about spring flowers. We heard one that was called, translates to Flowers of the Forest. And this is a traditional song from Finland, I believe. There was a man that lived in Ames for a while, and I got to know him. His name was John Berquist. He's a historian, a folklorist, and he did a lot of work in northern Minnesota with Scandinavian communities, the Finns and the Swedes and folks up there who were working in the Iron Range up there. He just kind of fascinated with all the old tales and all the old music, and he could play a fantastic accordion. He had accordions, he probably was one of those people that had way too many accordions. He would play polkas and waltzes and schottisches, and they were wonderful. So this is from a CD, an old CD, by John Berquist and his group called the Southside Swedes. And we heard a Swedish tune before. That was a Finnish tune. Anyway, this is a song called Out in Our Meadow. And it is a collection of the names of flowers that can be found in the meadow. And John's done a fine job of translating them into English so we can enjoy that. So this is you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, and this is KHOI. Let's listen to Out in Our Meadow, sung by John Berquist.
Out in our meadow, no berries so blue, come heart's delight. If you say yes, then I'll be there with you. Come columbine and come sweet lilies, come roses and come sweet salvia, come sweet scenting mint, come heart's delight. Flowers dance round and around, come heart's delight. I'll pick wild flowers to weave you a crown. Come columbine and come sweet lilies, come roses and come sweet salvia, come sweet scenting mint, come heart's delight. On your bright shining hair, come heart's delight. In sunlight and shadows, my hope rises there. Come columbine and come sweet lilies, come roses and come sweet salvia, come sweet scenting mint, come heart's delight. Out in our meadow, blueberries so sweet, some heart's delight. I love the wildflower that's the fairest of these. Come columbine and come sweet lilies, come roses.
Welcome back. There was some music from John Berquist about flowers out in the meadow. Ah, spring. Yes, it is. Well, in keeping with this potpourri smorgasbord kind of show that we have today, Donna, let's talk about frozen food. I bring this up.
You're cleaning out the end of the freezer?
I'm cleaning up my freezer, and actually we have a new freezer to move our old stuff into. So I'm thinking frozen food here. Okay. I pulled out a book that we've talked about before called What Einstein Told His Cook by the food writer Robert L. Wolk. And he kind of writes, he likes food, but he writes about food with kind of
a science
bent. So you learn things all the time. So thinking about frozen food, he's got some advice on how to defrost things. Now, traditionally, how is the air in your kitchen? Just set it on the counter. Yeah, they can do that. Yeah, it works. But but that probably takes too long, and the possibility for contamination is a bit much there. And soaking in water. You talked about water as a way
to... there is a... For a quick thaw in a restaurant, this is the technique, is you put, like, if you have to thaw shrimp, for example, or a lot of other things, chicken, you put it in a colander, in a container of water, but it is a law. You must have running water on it. You cannot just thaw it in a bucket of water. You have to have a faucet but the thing is, the water coming out of the faucet, the point of it is, has to be warm enough that the temperature keeps thawing, because if you have just set the whatever frozen thing in the water, eventually the water will get cold, and then you run into temperature ranges where bacterial contamination can grow. So the law is, you must thaw under running water. I mean, just it doesn't have to be fast flowing water, mm-hmm. but just dribbling enough to keep mm-hmm. the temperature warm so that it doesn't get too cold and it continues to thaw. That is the fastest way to thaw things.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. I often just put things in my sink overnight and let them thaw and dribble that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's the thing. What freezing does to food, because of course if you freeze, it expands, right? So it breaks the cell walls, for example, in vegetables, which is why they get mushy after they're frozen. So in thawing, you know, you want to be careful, because you will lose moisture. A thawed food mm-hmm. is, you know, there are plenty of chefs that will only use fresh meat, never frozen. I actually don't agree with that. I think there are hardly any instances where you can really taste the difference, but that's how people feel about it. So thawing, I never thaw in a microwave. Actually, I don't do anything in a microwave. There are people do, but I think you would run the risk of cooking the outer edges of it to some extent.
Yeah, he doesn't, Robert Wolk does not recommend microwave either, because it deals with the outside and doesn't get to the inside. Mm-hmm. The idea is getting those molecules moving. It's molecules of heat, and water is a pretty good conductor, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. he has this method I have never heard of before. He says, the quickest method of all, says Robert Wolk in the book, What Einstein Told His Cook, is to place, get this, the unwrapped frozen food on an unheated heavy skillet or
unheated.
Unheated, period. Metals are the champion heat conductors of all substances, because they have zillions of loose electrons that can transmit energy even better than moving other air molecules.
Metal is a really good conductor.
The metal panel conducts the room's heat very efficiently into the frozen food, thawing it in record time. Now, this is not a coated pan, not a non-stick pan, but like a,
cast iron skillet.
And you said your sinks were...
Right, my sinks are old and they are cast iron, and maybe, I mean, It's okay, but he says it's the fastest. It's still faster to thaw under running water. Yeah. That is a.
But anyway, I never thought of using your pan like that. And heaven, those molecules, I guess they are always busy. Those molecules working. Oh, goodness. Well, I have a little bit of news item here. The Dental and a Kitchen News Department. We haven't heard from them for a while, but there is a news item. There is some local news, some local gossip. The Alluvial Brewing Company, north of Ames, making fine beer and other stuff up there. They have invested and are now canning some of their fine brews. And what a little canner to can some things. So they will be selling some of their beer in cans, and these are big 16-ounce cans. They used to always, you could buy things in
growlers.
What a silly name, but in glass bottles, they would tap the beer and settle home in growlers. But it does not keep
the bubbles stay very well.
So three cheers for cans, and we'll see how that works out. Yes, we will.
Of course, the most fun is to go out and drink a beer on the patio on the prairie.
Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But cans, see, latest thing, little news item there. Well, we have some upcoming events here, and I wish to announce Earth Day is coming up this Thursday. Earth Day.
Oh, two more days. Okay.
Yeah, Earth Day. Okay. And KHOI is Johnny on the spot, as usual, announcing Earth Day Appreciation for 2021 at KHOI on Saturday, on Saturday, April 24th. They got some special programming from 7:45 to 5 p.m. Speakers, music, information throughout the day, and the opportunity to enjoy the natural resources, wonderful people, fascinating stories, and events happening around Ames. We look forward to a day of celebrating the Earth. Join us Saturday on KHOI, this fine radio station, April 24th, from 7:45 to 5 p.m. for some special programming. You are the community, and community radio is strengthening our community through communication. And we're sliding into some important stuff here. We have the KHOI fundraising season moving up here. KHOI, and this is great. KHOI presents Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey at Stevens Auditorium May 9th at 5 p.m. in a benefit concert for community radio. Purchase your concert hall tickets or live streaming tickets to watch from home by using the link at khoifm.org. Safety protocols will be in place at the CY Stevens. And thanks to Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey and the CY Stevens Auditorium for co-sponsoring this event. Funding for this concert provided by the Ames Commission on the Arts. Oh, fundraising. See, this is community radio. We get by not just with our sweat and toil here, Donna. No. We get by the whole community.
Of the community, by the community, and for the community.
Yes, this is a good radio station. Support this fine radio station. Oh, and by the way, keep up the good work with your COVID things. You know, keep washing your hands and
wear
your masks. And even if you get your shots, be kind of careful on how you go out and get back into things here. Good. It's not over yet. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We had music today by John Berquist and the Southside Swedes. Thanks to Joe Lynch for joining us today. My name is Lana Nachtel.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.